Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Mario Ritter, Lucia Malonig, Bruce Alpert, and Anne Ball. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will bring us the next part in our series on America's presidents. But first, Ugandans are reacting to new clothing requirements for government employees. Women in a government job are no longer permitted to wear a short skirt or large earrings. And male civil servants must wear a jacket and necktie in the office. The Ministry of Public Service released the requirements on decent dressing last week. The new rules have angered some civil servants. Women activists say the rules get Ugandans thinking about things other than the real issues facing the country. Perry Aratua is head of the Women's Democracy Network.
When a girl is dressed a certain way, that doesn't mean she's calling for your attention. Let us focus on the real issues that Ugandans are grappling with. The theft of our public resources, the inefficiency in service delivery, the absenteeism in public service, the capacity needs that public service has.
The directive bars female public employees from wearing tight clothing, open-toed shoes, and skirts or dresses above the knees. Bright-colored nail polish, hair extensions, and exaggerated makeup are also on the banned list. Male public servants must wear dark pants, but they cannot be too tight around the legs. And men may only wear closed-toe black or brown shoes. Ada Muwanga is the human resource manager at the Ministry of Public Service.
People in Uganda have a perception of what a public officer should look like, and this is the image we are trying to protect and preserve. We are saying not above the knee. And for one reason, above the knee, you know what it means? It can also tantamount to sexual harassment. Because when you sit, you're exposing your thighs, which is not generally accepted. And it can distract others from work.
Rights groups say earlier guidance to civil servants was enough. A 2010 public order required clothing to be neat and practical for one's job. Ugandans have written to local newspapers about the new rules. One lawyer noted that rights are taken away overnight. They are taken away in small bits. A reporter working for VOA spoke to a government employee who did not want to tell her name.
Yeah, I think my bright eyes can't distract someone, so the government should not discuss about that.
The punishments for disobeying the new rules are unclear. The order said violations would be reported to the permanent secretary of the Ministry of Public Service.
China has asked the country's three top internet providers to prevent cell phone users from getting access to online material that it does not control. Reports say the telecommunications companies China Mobile, China Unicom, and China Telecom have been told about the policy. The goal appears to be to keep the companies from permitting access to content not approved by the government. This month, the Chinese government reportedly shut down a popular virtual private network service, GreenVPN. Virtual private networks, or VPNs, permit users to send secure information over an open internet connection. They are popular ways for internet users in China to get access to internet content outside of China. The move was seen as part of a government campaign to license only companies that it trusted. However, China's Ministry of Information has denied that it licensed the company Chuanglian VPN to sell its services. It went on to note that the company involved has never received a telecommunications business license from either the Ministry of Information Industry or the Ministry of Communications. In January, China increased efforts to control the internet by banning unauthorized internet connections. Such connections can include those provided by VPNs. China's Ministry of Industry and Information Technology said the government has set a goal of doing this by the end of March, according to the state-run Global Times. Many Chinese internet users are able to use software and services to avoid Chinese government censorship of online material. One blogger, known as Zola, who is a free speech activist, said it is not clear if all VPN activity will be banned from the beginning of February. Zola said the government could do this, but it would be costly to carry out such a ban. If the authorities really want to shut down all VPNs so that only protocol ports it trusted were able to get online, and all the others were blocked, this would be very difficult, and it would cost a lot of money. Zola doubted that the government would want to harm the economy by closing down VPNs completely. Another internet user, who did not want to be named, said, "It seems as if everything's going to get a whole lot stricter from February 1st next year." The user added, "This will affect our ability to visit overseas websites, because right now they can only be viewed with VPN." I'm Mario Ritter.
A new study explores the custom of tipping in the United States. Many Americans give tips to people who perform a job for them, especially workers in the service industry. They pay a little extra to people cutting their hair, driving them across town, or serving them a meal at a restaurant. The new survey was done for the website creditcards.com. Princeton Survey Research Associates questioned over 1,000 individuals. The subjects were asked about how and when they offered tips. The researchers found that men give bigger tips to restaurant workers than women. It also found people allied with the Republican Party give bigger tips than supporters of the Democratic Party. And people who live in the northern U.S. are more generous with tips than those living in the south. The survey found that people who earn $50,000 or more a year give bigger tips than those who earn less than $50,000. One likely reason, the wealthier Americans have more money to spend.
The report also said that when getting a haircut, 67% always tip the person doing the cutting, while 12% never do. In a coffee shop, 29% always tip the person preparing their coffee, while 30% never do. And when staying at a hotel, 27% always tip the housekeeping crew, and 31% never do. Michael Lin is a professor of consumer behavior and marketing at the Cornell University School of Hotel Administration in New York. In other words, he knows a lot about the issue of tipping. In earlier surveys, Lin said, he found mixed results on the generosity of men and women when it comes to tipping. In some studies, men gave bigger tips than women. In others, women gave more money. Lin's own research found that men give bigger tips when the restaurant server is a woman, and women give more when the server is a man.
Lin said that in any survey dealing with human generosity, people can say they give more than they really do. There is no way of finding out if people answering a researcher's questions are telling the truth. CreditCards.com spoke to one server at a restaurant in Virginia. She said, "All of the really big tips I've gotten have been from men, and some of the really bad ones have been from groups of women. I think sometimes men tip more because they're trying to impress someone." Tips are very important to service employees. People who work at restaurants often get most of their earnings from tips. Nationwide, Americans generally tip between 15 to 20% at restaurants and leave from $2 to $10 a day for the people who clean their hotel rooms. Tips of 15% are also common for people who drive taxis.
In 2015, Condé Nast Traveler magazine published a report on tipping around the world. Here are some of its findings about restaurants. In Nigeria, a 10% tip is enough if a service charge has not already been added to the cost of a restaurant meal. In Brazil, no tip is required because a 10% service charge is generally added on restaurant bills. In Cambodia, add $1 for the server. In Indonesia, a 10% tip is added to the bill, but diners often leave a little extra money. In Vietnam, a service charge is not usually added to the restaurant bill. If that's the case, you should add a 10% tip, and more if you use a credit card. But here is something to keep in mind. If you are able to give the person serving you a tip or a bigger one than what is expected, your generosity will be welcome. Many service workers do not make much money, and even an extra dollar or two can make a difference in their lives. I'm Bruce Salpert.
And I'm Lucia Malonig.
microbeads are tiny pieces of plastic used in many products to help clean skin or teeth. They are found in many kinds of exfoliants in skin and beauty products. The microbeads help to remove dead skin cells and make skin smoother. But these very small pieces of plastic go right into the ocean. Janet Scott is a chemist and researcher at England's University of Bath.
If you were washing yourself once a day with a microbead-containing formulation to give you that nice smooth glow that you get when you use an abrasive formulation, you would be putting something like 80 to 100,000 microbeads down the drain every time you did that.
After going down the drain, those thousands of plastic microbeads go into the ocean. They are too small to be captured in wastewater treatment plants. They then become part of the more than 8 million tons of plastic that end up in the oceans every year. The microbeads may absorb or take on poisons in the water. This hurts fish that eat the plastic, thinking it is food. Those fish may later end up being in a human's meal. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency reports that oceans are not the only waters affected. The Great Lakes, rivers, and estuaries also contain microbeads and other microplastics. In 2015, the United States banned the use of plastic microbeads in products like soap and toothpaste. Several other countries, mostly in Europe, have also called for banning their use. Now, British researchers are using cellulose to create microbeads. Cellulose is a substance found in plants. It is biodegradable. Unlike plastic, it will naturally break down or degrade over time. Janet Scott explains.
Because of the way cellulose degrades, it should degrade in the wastewater treatment plant. It shouldn't even make it into the oceans.
Researchers make the microbeads by pushing the cellulose through a very small steel membrane. The researchers are working with a British firm called Micropore Technologies. They will help take the production of cellulose microbeads to an industrial level. Other natural products are also being used in place of plastic. They include the pit or center of apricot fruits and the shells of nuts. The pits and shells are ground up and are rough enough to be exfoliants. They, along with jojoba beads, have been used for years by cosmetics manufacturers. So has pumice, a lightweight stone formed by volcanic activity. It has long been used in many kinds of exfoliating and cleaning products. I'm Anne Ball.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about James Garfield. He was the 20th President of the United States. Garfield is not one of the best-known presidents. He served only 100 days before he was shot. 11 weeks later, he died from his wounds. But even during Garfield's short time in office, historians say his presidency had problems. Like the president before him, Rutherford B. Hayes, Garfield was from the state of Ohio. Garfield's father died when he was very young. The future president was raised largely by his mother, two older sisters, and a brother. Among all the presidents, Garfield probably was the most poor in his early years. Growing up, he worked as a farmer, a sailor, a carpenter, a teacher, and a janitor. Finally, he earned a position as a student at Williams College in Western Massachusetts. Garfield loved learning. He eventually taught at a school called the Eclectic Institute. Later, he became its president. Garfield married one of his students at the Eclectic Institute, Lucretia Rudolph. She became a teacher, too. The future president and his wife went on to have 7 children. 4 sons and a daughter survived to adulthood. In time, Garfield moved out of education and into law and politics. He was an anti-slavery activist who did not think the Southern states had a right to withdraw from the Union. When the Civil War came, Garfield welcomed it. During the war, Garfield served in the military as an officer. He won awards for his bravery. While still a young man, he was appointed to the position of Major General. His image as a war hero was so great that Garfield did not have to campaign for a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. He was elected on his name alone. Garfield's way of thinking changed while he was in Congress. He began as one of the most extreme radical Republicans. He wanted to punish former Confederate officers severely. But in time, Garfield softened his positions. He learned to compromise with other groups in order to achieve results for his state. But he did not always represent the interests of workers or farmers in Ohio. Garfield supported business interests that wanted to limit the country's money supply. He opposed labor unions and cooperative farm programs, called the Grange. Garfield also became linked to a corruption case. He accepted stock shares in a company that was building a railroad across the country. In exchange, Garfield and other top officials eased government rules so businessmen could earn higher profits for their work. Although Garfield's political career sometimes drew criticism, he continued to rise in government. When Garfield became president in March 1881, he did not have what Americans call a mandate, the approval of a large part of the population. Instead, he needed to make compromises with lawmakers to help win their support. As a result, the first weeks of his presidency were a political struggle to appoint members to his cabinet of advisors. Garfield also clashed with a powerful senator from New York State. The senator wanted to continue the tradition of permitting senators to choose who got government jobs in their states. But President Garfield wanted to put someone who shared his own beliefs in some of the top positions in New York. Finally, the senator resigned in protest. But the issue set the tone for Garfield's short time in office. Elected officials battled each other for advantages and financial gain. Officials in Garfield's party were accused of corruption and wrongdoing. And before Garfield could really suggest any ideas for government reform, he was shot by someone seeking a government job in exchange for his political support. On July 2, 1881, fewer than 4 months after he took office, Garfield was leaving for a short trip with two of his sons. They were going to take a train to Williams, the college Garfield had attended and loved. The president was supposed to give a speech there. But as he walked through the train station, a man with a gun stepped behind Garfield and shot the president twice. One bullet touched Garfield's arm. The other went into his lower back. Garfield did not die immediately. Instead, he was taken back to the White House, where doctors tried to remove the bullet. One of the men who tried was Alexander Graham Bell, the inventor of the telephone. Bell tried to find the bullet by using a device like a metal detector that he had invented. But the springs on Garfield's bed interfered. Neither Bell nor the doctors were able to remove the bullet. And, some historians say, their efforts may have made the situation worse. Garfield suffered for more than 2 months. At one point, he seemed to be recovering. But on September 19th, he finally died. He was 49 years old. As for the gunman, he was captured shortly after the shooting. His name was Charles Guiteau. Guiteau was a lawyer with little money, but many mental problems. During the election of 1880, he had first supported the candidacy of former President Ulysses S. Grant. When Garfield won the Republican nomination instead, Guiteau supported him. Guiteau did not have an official role in the election campaign, and Garfield did not know him. But over time, Guiteau came to believe that he was responsible for Garfield winning the presidency. As a result, Guiteau thought Garfield owed him a government job. Guiteau wrote the president several letters requesting positions as a diplomat in Europe. When Garfield did not write back, Guiteau grew angry. He believed Garfield was ruining the Republican Party and destroying the country. For weeks, Guiteau followed the president and plotted to kill him. When he succeeded in shooting Garfield, Guiteau believed he had performed a great service. At his trial, a jury decided that Guiteau was sane. In other words, he was not too mentally unbalanced to be responsible for his crime. Almost a year after he shot the president, Guiteau himself was hanged. Thus, the most dramatic event in James Garfield's presidency came to an end. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.